Can I interject a question?
Yes.
Well, you've been going for quite a while now, and it was quite a ways back, but I've been thinking about it since you said it, that you mentioned that you'd lost interest in the mystery schools and the whole occult path of knowledge and moved to a spiritual, more spiritual thing. What would you say is the difference between those two?
Well, I think that the difference is one I'd call a mystery school, one I'd call a wisdom school. Okay, that to me is the difference. Okay, one is mystery, one is wisdom. So, and my understanding is that the wisdom schools they lead to happiness, and the mystery schools do not. So that is the difference for me.
Right. So, I guess I've explored both to some degree or another. It's all relative, right? But I've also explored both more recently at a more social, cultural, parapolitical through that kind of lens, in terms of social engineering and how these philosophies, disciplines, memes, what have you, and the groups that propagate them seem to be cooperating with or even implementing social engineering plans that have nothing to do with anyone's happiness, I don't think, much less their spiritual wholeness. So, and my tentative view at this point is that there isn't really any difference. I mean, I've seen so much overlap between occultism and so-called spirituality, and certainly the goal's more or less the same, transcending duality. And what I find is the common thread, really, is this pursuit of happiness, which in occultism is called the will to power, right? But it's the same thing, dressed up differently. And what I've experienced for myself, and this, I think that you're wise to always refer to yourself rather than to others, because of course we don't even know what's going on with the other. But for myself, I've definitely observed now 49, so I started on the path consciously around 24, so half my life, is that it's the whole time it's been the fragment. It's been the fragment, the constructed identity of what's called the ego in some spiritual things, the false identity that's been driving me towards spiritual wholeness, towards self-empowerment, towards happiness, towards enlightenment, towards whatever, you know, term I put on it. That's always been what's been driving me, and hence, of course, it can't ever attain it. That part would just get integrated and dissolved into the total psyche and lose more or less its existence. So there's been, it's like a dog chasing its tail, essentially. It was fun to begin with, but after a certain time, it became more and more serious. It was always pretty serious. I was always pretty serious, although it started with comic books, superheroes, and those kind of myths. But it was all about this, for me, this traumatized fragment that had been totally powerless and experienced the intense anxiety, to use that word, and bodily, you know, all of those chemicals that got trapped in the body and became poisons, that intense powerlessness and anxiety that shaped the constructed identity to be driven to attain power at any cost, you know, just to feel safe. So in the end, it's been the only thing that's worked for me has been slowly letting go of the drive to change myself, to attain anything, to feel powerful, and be in the experience of being powerless and the anxiety of it, and not really do anything about it except, I mean, express it in ways. And it's not as though I'm becoming, you know, just one of these guys who just sits at the bars and talk about football. I realize there's a middle way, which is neither the spiritual seeker hell-bent on, you know, self-empowerment, nor the, you know, the average person that seems to be sleepwalking through their life and unaware of it. This middle way, for me, has been kind of to be neither by fusing the two together. So now my so-called spiritual path is, besides these sort of podcasts and things I write, whereas I'm an investigator or a detective, I like to unpack these mysteries, what have you. It's really become the cliche, really, of chopping wood and carrying water. Like, I run a thrift store, and that's become a spiritual practice. I mean,
Right.
I don't want to, inflate it, because that's what I'm saying is the danger of spiritualizing stuff. It, but just being present in the present, I suppose, being embodied, has finally started to work
That's
by,
beautiful to hear. I mean, that's beautiful to hear. And this to me is exactly the process. So, it's where I live, we do chop wood and carry water, and I chuckle to myself. I chuckle, I have to get a wheelbarrow, get the water containers, walk across the meadow, get to a standpipe, get the water, wheel it back. And it's kind of very often I just kind of think, I'm just, this is what I'm doing, chopping wood, carry water. This before and after and this kind of thing. And we're chopping the wood, for the wood burner stove, chop, 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 chop. And so this sense of the one's work is the spiritual path is exactly where I'm at. We're having this pointed, delivered, precise conversation, but this is the sort of this is the nature of what we're talking about. We can talk about running a thrift shop or chopping wood, which is ostensibly the same thing from us, but we're drawing our two points together to kind of meet and match at the middle. But this idea that to integrate the spiritual life into one's everything one does is the totality of my life as well. So, I had this kind of, as I say, I studied, trained 13 years hardcore. I never missed a class, all the retreats. I was kind of, I did it. And I was kind of quite a bright student. I kind of, when I was, and we had lots of debate. And there's a kind of funny little story. And I kind of, got very skillful at debate. And part of the sort of Tibetan Buddhist thing is you kind of debate, and you debate to sort of, it's like doing kung fu with training in kung fu. So if someone puts you on your back, fantastic, you've learned. And how did you do that? And can you teach me that? And this was kind of like intellectual kung fu, or spiritual kung fu. And again, if you beat somebody, they'd be, oh, fantastic. It wasn't. It was like you wanted to train, so you wanted to have the toughest guy to fight with, or a guy, I don't know, monk, nun, whoever, because the engagement was just so exciting, and you wanted to win. If you lost, it was good. If you won, it was good. And so, I kind of got quiet. I'm quite good, if that's the right word, at what I did. And then I kind of I could quite lock horns, and sometimes I could be quite sort of strong, over strong with people. People, if I thought people were being a bit, I was probably a bit too big to my own boots, but having done it for so long, sometimes people would come in and you'd just, be a bit cocky, and you'd just put them on their back, sort of thing, straight away. And I kind of did it to this guy who was a monk, and he got rather upset. I kind of shot him down a bit, which was, anyway, I did it. And so I didn't feel bad about it, but it wasn't particularly a skillful thing on my part. But anyway, so I'd been studying this school for a long time, and this monk got really angry with me, and he kind of went out the room and came back into the room with a saucepan and a frying pan, came up behind me, I wasn't aware he was there, and he hit me on with a saucepan on one side, head bang, and a frying pan, head bang. And this is in a room of 30, 40 people in a Buddhist center. So it was, what, where's that come from? So I kind of, and then after this thing, the head teacher kind of said, I think you're a bit disruptive, Mark. Whatever, I was the one that was asked to go, so it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. So at that point, I was kind of a bit distraught. I've been with the training with these guys for years and years and years. I say guys, but it was equally men and women. And I found myself kind of adrift and lost, and but I realized at that point, or about 6 months later, that all the intellectual stuff I had, and a head full of scriptures, and I could debate any of the fine, subtle academic points, and it was all up here in my head. And I kind of thought, okay, I've got to just make this my life now. I'm not going back there. So I've done my training, I've done my all my stuff, and now I've got to make this my entire life. Get it out of my head into my heart. You know, it's kind of metaphor of the heart. So take it into the heart. And as a result of that, I'm now a sort of maverick, unconventional, working with the processes, my own processes, to understand and realize enlightenment, let's say. So so you know, I chop wood, I carry water, I do my drawings, I live my life, see my kids, party now and again, do this, that and the other, but I'm always on the spiritual tip, even though I can't, it might not appear it. I'm kind of, it's never, the conversation is there all the time. So running a thrift shop, being a butcher, digging holes in the road, I don't know anyone's mind. I don't know the sort of president of the United States, a torturer. You know, it's like it all looks wrong to me, but I do not know. I do not know. And the line, there's the classic line that I always come back to is, appearances are deceptive and my own opinion is unreliable. Appearances are deceptive, my own opinions are unreliable. And it's like, because I just do not know anything other than my own version of things. I don't know what you're thinking. I don't have these cities where I can read minds. You know, of course we can intuit and read body languages and pick up vibes and this kind of stuff, but I do not know. So the only thing I can know is what's going on in my own mind. You know, so your life, your spiritual life, is as valid as Buddha's. It's as valid as Crowley's. It's about, you know, I can't make that. I can't. You know, it might look like so and so is doing a bad job about this, but really, do I know that? Or is, what's the relationship between the torture in, Syria, or me? What's that relationship? What's the relationship between the cruelest person in the planet and myself? There's a dependency. There's a relationship between the two of us, because if I wasn't aware or conscious, it's not really there until I know of it. It's like, it's just part of my dream. So it's like I am somehow contributing to that. There's a relationship. It's kind of, there's a dependent relationship.
Yeah.
So this running a thrift shop. So my main story of my life was I was an antiques dealer. So I kind of started off, you know, going, you know, boot fair, you know, it's a long time ago, and I ended up kind of quite high up in the antiques thing. So the processes of running a business, they're no less spiritual than being a gardener. This kind of, you know, I salute you running a thrift shop, and running a thrift shop is probably great fun these days, you know.
You get some
great stuff. Are you a collector?
No, I'm not a collector. I'm the opposite, generally. I have very few possessions and don't really like accumulating stuff. So this is perfect. I mean, but this is really the next level of non-attachment, because we have absolutely everything we need, right? Whatever. It's just constantly coming in. So yeah. So it's... but there's many different levels to it, in terms of it being what I need, at a soul level, for my own embodiment, you know, just to become more aware of who I am or what I am. I mean, life provides these opportunities. The more we are responsive to it, responsible and responsive to life, the more it provides us what we actually need, I think. And so this is me having that experience, and better late than never, you know.
It's so good to not only hear you say that, but feel you saying that as well. It's kind of like, okay, and it's like I felt you saying that, and it's kind of, that is beautiful. And to me, it's like, whoa, why don't you ever stop thinking like that? Why don't you ever stop giving out that contentment, that whatever you were issuing there that I hear and feel through this binary soup stuff? It was like, whoa, I felt this kind of I don't know quite what it was, but this beautiful feeling, and that tonality or whatever intonation, whatever, it was like, that is you, man. That was so lovely to feel. And it's like that's it. Whatever that is, whatever chemical that was going through your body then, that is your medicine, man. That to me, it's like, if you've got trauma, take that, whatever the feeling. My partner's just come in, it's all right, she's a yoga teacher. So whatever that feeling was that you were feeling, that I felt, that is the nature of your medicine. And whenever you do your yogas or your whatevers, work with that biochemical or neurological chemical, and that is the medicine for the trauma. That is how you, it's like, take that in to your, so when you next go to the yoga class, what, that's okay, take that in, and you will flood and flush your body with that. And that's what I did, that's what I do when I did these drawings. I kind of did them and go, okay, I want to feel that, I want to flood my body with that. So there's a practical application of who and what you are with the embodiment of the physical asana. So you will be, okay, that's the medicine that feels so great for me, or you sounded so good.
Well, good, yeah. But I don't want to milk it, you know. I don't want to actually, because I've noticed this in my own experience relating to what I was saying earlier about the path, is that once my mind gets a hold of an experience, it's gone. It goes. Like, I start to turn it into a current. The mind wants to turn it into a currency and say, I did this, how can I do more of it? And so it's a very fine line for me, I've noticed, between letting myself observe it and then putting my hands on it and trying to direct it.
Okay, well, let's consider it a body memory then.
Yeah.
So which is kind of what the nature of trauma we're discussing anyway. So yeah. It's not an intellectual thing, or it is a visceral body memory. So the body memory you have of that is like, okay, is not nothing to do. We can say in that case, it's nothing to do with the mind for this purpose. It's nothing to do with the mind. So what it's like, indulge it, because it's a chemical that, okay, it's a body memory. It's, you know, and I'm trying to sort of.
Yeah. I think it's more than the chemical.
It's kind of anachronism in your mind about milking it, but it's like, okay, it's worth a go.
I think it's more than a chemical. I think that's the psyche. When we start to feel the psyche in the body or through the body, our connection to the universe or the source, that, yeah, for sure we can milk that, because that's infinite.
Yeah.
But we don't, on the other hand, we don't really have to milk it, because it's constantly flowing anyway. So, yes, just being aware of it and following the awareness.
Fast and tree will play your hands, a job that suits you right. Not a girl, another world, dancing in the dark. Oh yeah, oh yeah, I'm waltzing with you in the dark. Oh yeah, oh yeah, I'm waltzing with you in the dark.
So There was a subject, a less serious subject I did want to get onto before we finish, but can you continue a bit longer, or do you?
Yeah, sure. Helena's here, but she's totally cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, because it doesn't follow on directly from what we just touched on at all, but a little bit earlier you were talking about the wrongness, how you see the wrongness, but you don't know, you know, whether it is wrong or not. So this is the question in itself, you know, what does wrong mean, and the difference between a moral sense of wrongness, which is an opinion, which, as you've said, they're always unreliable, and a sense of wrongness in that, well, this doesn't benefit the system, let's say, so it's wrong in that sense. So it'd be wrong for me to drink Coca-Cola every day. I don't even like it, but you know, it wouldn't be morally wrong, but my system wouldn't like it, so it would be a bad idea, put it that way. So I wanted to apply that to circumcision, because that was how I ended up listening to you to begin with, was somebody, Paige White, who listens to this podcast. He's very interested in circumcision and the harm it does to children's psyche, and so he directed me to that podcast, I guess it's certainly something that people have strong opinions about, right? But I think there's a ground of reality there as well, which is largely what my process is about. It's not about trying to sort the good from the bad, but the false opinions from the facts, you know, from the physical facts. So, I'm not circumcised, I'm glad to say. So I can't speak about it from experience, but my feeling about it is that it's really wrong. There's a real wrongness around it. But you have direct experience, and if you want to just talk a little bit about that, what you talked about on the podcast I heard about the trauma around circumcision, and then maybe we can dig into that a little bit.
Okay, so the experience, so being, you know, I can say, you know, I don't know what it's like not to be circumcised, so I can't make a value judgment any statement about whether it's better or not. Everything's fine, but the sort of what brought this up was I was lying down about 5-6 years ago, 7 years ago, and this is, you know, after years of this hardcore Ashtanga practice, and I thought I'd found all the traumas in my body. I kind of released when I got hit and all these kind of things that had gone on in my childhood, and then I realized that the last trauma, or I don't know if it's the last, was, I can remember, it's kind of a funny word in this case, I can remember being taken away from my mum's arms to be circumcised, but I can't what I can remember is my mum's plaintive, probably, it might have been vocal, but probably energetic sense that I was being taken away from her. So my understanding is, you know, I was in her tummy for 9 months, you know, did her, building up a relationship. My mum was lovely, was dead, lovely. And so I can't remember the age. You know, in Yiddish tradition, Jewish tradition, you know, a few days old, you're taken away, or you're circumcised, a few days old. So, but what I could find in my, what found me, or what I found, was I can recall my mum's energetic pain at her son being taken away to have the end of his dick cut off. So my mum wasn't Jewish. She converted to Judaism because, you know, she wanted to marry my dad. I've got 2 elder sisters, so this hadn't happened to my sisters. So she was kind of like, probably knew it was coming, but wasn't prepared for her little baby boy of 3 or 4 days, I don't know, a few days old, to be taken away and have the end of his dick cut off. So... and that is what I didn't feel the, I can't isolate the physical trauma of it happening, but I can identify my mum's plaintive pain, which I kind of relate to that process. So that is where I found that experience. So, and from a right or wrong, I consider it to be wrong, 100% wrong. I cannot see any justification. You know, I got all the normal spiel, you know, when I was a, you know, it's healthy and tradition and it happened to everybody, and it's, you won't remember it, so it doesn't matter, all this kind of thing, you know, all the standard rollouts. But as you possibly heard when I was talking to those other guys, it's just about a sinister, an occult, dark, black magic thing that I can almost imagine. Let's try introducing that today and see how far you get. You know, it's like you'd get a lot, you know, you get 20 years straight away, wouldn't you? It's kind of, so there's this kind of grave, I don't know. Yeah, I to me it's wrong. I can't see any right in it whatsoever. Or, well, right being R-I-T-E, or right, you know, I can't see anything good in it whatsoever. You know, I don't understand it. What's your take? What do you think about what I've said? Or
was it also part of the ceremony? I was just trying to find the phrase online because it's impossible for me to remember, but, and I didn't want to put it in the ball terms, but, you know, where the rabbi sucks the baby's penis afterwards?
I don't know. I very probably, but I don't know for sure. I don't know about the you see, there's classes of Judaism, you know, liberal, orthodox, ultra-orthodox, and we were what's described as liberal Jews, but I do not know if they did that or not. I don't know. It's possible, and I'm kind of, now I'm feeling this visceral discomfort at the thought of that. It's like, God, that happened to me. But you know, you've brought it up, and good. It's, but I don't know. You know, I could ask my dad, actually.
Do you know the name of the ritual?
Do I want to know the name of it?
No, okay. Do you know the name? Because I didn't find it. So,
no.
Yeah.
I'm kind of, you know, I'm very sort of confused about this sort of Abrahamic.
It's a real, wow, it's a basket of snakes. It goes back so far and it's so central to our culture. I mean, Judaism really is the underlying fabric of it, I think. And so this ritual itself somehow is, I mean, not that everyone's been circumcised, although of course non-Jews have been circumcised in the US at least for generations now. It's no longer a Judaic thing, only the actual circumcision itself. So there's various things to look at there. I mean, one is just the purely physical thing. Okay, so yeah, where did that come from? I mean, what could possibly be the physical rationale besides hygiene, which is just ridiculous, as you pointed out on the other conversation, for cutting off a foreskin, you know, a baby's foreskin? The only thing I've heard, the only possible physical explanation I've heard is quite a sinister one, and that is because it desensitizes the penis, it makes it easier for them as adults to rape women. That's the only physical explanation I've heard for that.
Okay, it desensitizes the penis and makes... Okay, wow, I've never heard that. That's kind of... I really... Okay, I cannot relate to that whatsoever.
Well, yeah, I would hope not, but you did on the warification of the male, you know, through this traumatizing thing, how it creates warriors, and of course that's the tradition for the warriors to rape the women.
This is part of the, well, the warrior thing. You've reminded me of another thought I had around that same time, was that the Jews are ostensibly the persecuted ones. You know, it's kind of this history of persecution, and, you know, the pogroms, the, you know, the story of Egypt and all this kind of stuff. You know, there's stories, man, there's stories. But yeah, there's this sense that I kind of almost feel sort of slightly guilty at saying this, is that it could be that there's this general collective anger within Jewish males that kind of almost provoke some sort of response, whether it's intended or it's so subtle. It's almost like there's a degree of provocative behavioral within Jews that cause this kind of anger towards them, that could be as a result of this kind of circumcision. And it's like I find it very hard to understand that they perhaps this kind of tradition is part of a system of continuing this kind of warlike and slightly antagonistic, but playing the victim. But it's such sensitive ground, man. It's like I really can't tease it apart, and you know, I'd have to wait for a sort of an understanding to come to me, because I cannot put those bits together in my mind. But somehow there's an aspect of the history of the suffering of the Jews that's related to circumcision. I cannot separate the two. It's like there's a reason why the you know, people, or the German, let's say, you know, I'm going to use the crass thing, the Nazis hated the Jews. It's somehow related to circumcision, necessarily, because that's the distinction. That is the unifying thing between Jewish males, isn't it? It's because they've been circumcised. So there's something in that, but I cannot understand, and it's a great mystery.
Well, there's one thing here that might be relevant or helpful, is that it's a repetition compulsion that comes from trauma. So there's an unconscious need, when we're traumatized, to reenact the circumstances of the trauma. So this is why people who are sexually abused, more specifically women, to use this example, women who are sexually abused as infants are much more, or children are much more likely to be raped as teenagers or later on. However that works, okay. I mean, it's a psychological mechanism. We're trying to resolve something in the past that can't be resolved because you can't change the past, and so we unconsciously reenact. So yeah, then that could to some extent account for how the Jewish people have attracted persecution. I mean, it could of course be very mundane and profane things in terms of the Nazis recognizing something about circumcision, and as you call it, as this black magic ritual, not a term I generally use, but if anything befits it, I would agree, something like this maybe does. And of course it is, I mean, is before I finish, I'm going to make the point about Abraham and his son, but before I do, is circumcision actually prescribed in the Old Testament, do you know?
No, I don't know.
I don't think it is. I think
and the Old Testament, what fascinates me about the Old Testament is the first words, in the beginning.
Yeah.
In the beginning, and there's something. I think it's the best composed sentence in Western literature. There is no more powerful phrase than "in the beginning." It's beyond masterful. And it draws this line. It's so beautiful. God, I wish I'd come up with that one myself. In the beginning, because it's not the beginning. It's so obviously not, and so all the stories are dependent upon this one line, in the beginning. Without that, there's no Bible. Without that opening statement, that sentence, there's no Bible. So whatever is stacked up on top of it, whatever I've kind of no interest in the stories, you know, some beautiful, some are insane things, whether circumcision's there or not, that is just something that's stacked upon this phrase in the beginning. And what really interests me is what was before the beginning.
Right.
And this is this whole sense that there's, you know, the birth and death of the universe, which we seem to be going to back to the beginning via the Hadron Collider, and we're looking out towards the end, which is the the Hubble and the next generations of studying the stars, where they're going to kind of, where, as you said, the dog chasing its tail, or the Ouroboros, it's going to be the same thing. So the whole thing is going to be encapsulated in a kind of, it's going to be held or captured or seen, or that's it, this epiphany of like the end is the beginning and vice versa. And so this whole in the beginning, which is just kind of another one of the stories, it's relevant, but it's as irrelevant as a leaf blowing down your street right now. It's of no more importance ultimately than that. Yeah. So to me, the real interest is kind of negating the entire sequence, and going before the beginning.
Right.
I want to go before that, or if that word works in that context. But I just don't. That's where I want to go with it. So if there's something in the Bible, I wouldn't know.
There is. I found it while you were talking.
Okay.
I've never cried all my life till I met you, girl. It's simple, oh, you're really cruel. You never see me when I want you to. You got me gone, I got you too. If you're scared, I'll come to the rescue. You know I'm falling in love, girl. I'll pick myself up from the whole world. The way you move, I'm shivering. It's a sea of love that I'm drowning in. Well, you don't know, I'll make it clear. You got someone who loves you dear. I know you're scared, afraid of love, but I'm here to make your heart rise above. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me? Lucy on my mind. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me? Lucy on my mind. Oh, Lucy, ah, Lucy, you got me hotter than the center of the sun. Oh, Lucy, yeah, Lucy, you got me sitting in the cuckoo sweat. Oh, you said, Lucy, you're gonna be mine, but you know that you're not even trying. I sent you flowers just to tell you how I feel, but I still don't know if your love for me is real. I know I'm traumatizing, but when the sun is shining, I think of you. It gets my tongue tied, it gets my mind fried, it gets my eyes wide open. Now I see, so I sing. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me? Lucy on my mind. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me? Lucy on my mind. Oh, Lucy, ah, Lucy, you get me shivers right down my backbone. Oh, Lucy, yeah, Lucy, you get me hot even when I'm in the cold. Oh, Lucille, what even is your deal? I send you all my love, but then you file an appeal. Am I mistaken? Are you still taken? It seems to me to be the latter of the two. I want you to fly into my arms, untie your chains and show me all your charm. I want you to hold me real tight. I tell you that I love you and that everything's alright. I want you to want me. I'm on my knees just to beg and just to plead. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. Lucy, won't you choose me? Lucy on my mind. Lucy, Lucy, Lucy on my mind. won't you choose me? Let me see you on my mind. Please, please, Lucy. Please, Lucy. Please, please, Lucy.
It's Genesis 17. And Jehovah says to Abraham, this is my covenant with you and your descendants after you, the covenant you are to keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You are to undergo circumcision, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and you. For the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised, including those born in your household or bought with money from a foreigner, those who are not your offspring. Oh, there's child trafficking there already. Whether born in your household or bought with your money, they must be circumcised. My covenant in your flesh is to be an everlasting covenant. Any uncircumcised male who has not been circumcised in the flesh will be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. So that's a pretty serious threat there in terms of isolation from the tribe. You know, that's really a fundamental threat to survival, this idea of being ostracized from the tribe. And then, of course, much more famously, Abraham and Isaac. You know, the where Jehovah says, "I want you to kill your son," and then, only kidding. That's Genesis 22, so that's five chapters after that. I think there's a connection. Is all I can begin to say anyway between the circumcision covenant and this idea that to be true to Jehovah, our Father who art in heaven, who says I am the only God, thereby implying that there must be others. He says I'm a jealous God, and I'm the only one. So if he's the only one, why is he jealous, right? But anyway, that's a side thing. The Jehovah is demanding the sort of symbolic sacrifice of the top of the infant male's penis, and then also demands this literal sacrifice of the son, only as a test, but to prove Abraham's devotion to him. If you're willing to kill your own son, then you're worthy of me, roughly. So my sense is that this has something to do, like with a psychological mechanism, or whatever we want to call it, that has to do with the father taking complete ownership of the psyche of the son, like using it as a vehicle to possess it in some way, so that the son is complete, has no autonomy. The son is merely an extension of the father. This is the patriarchal lineage.
Okay, I like it. I like it. I think you've actually kind of nailed it a bit there. I think there's sort of implies dominance through fear and
trauma,
pain.
Yeah.
I think you've nailed it. Actually, I think that feels right, Jason. And it's kind of, I almost cried when you were talking there, just thinking about that, thinking about the whole process. And do you have children?
I don't, and this is partly why, I'm sure, even though I wasn't raised in that, you know, the particular Judaic tradition, it's gone beyond Judaism, as we know, and it's how power works, I think. How hierarchical power, abusive power, works is by creating these lineages that prevent autonomy, by preventing embodiment through trauma, so that the son is kind of a vessel of the ancestors, which Saturn as well. So I'll just interject before you respond,
sure.
Because it came up on the other podcast. It relates to Saturn as well, because Saturn devoured his children, and symbolically, if this isn't too fanciful, the circumcision is a ring, right? You remove this ring.
Yeah, this kind of, you know, drawing these kind of sink-like analogies is always a sort of bit of a thin line for me. But what I've thought about was you say you have a friend that's very interested in circumcision or very vocal about it.
Yeah.
Is there an anti-circumcision movement within the Judaic tradition, or is it never going to happen, or are there rebel Jews that are taking? It's like, no, I'm not going to have my son circumcised. Is that a conversation that's going on in the Jewish, or is it becoming more less likely now, or is it more likely now? I have no idea about the conversation, if even there is a conversation in the Jewish community about the rights and wrongs.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, the fact that I'm talking to you as a result of asking this Paige White if there was anyone I could talk to who was vocally challenging circumcision within the community or anywhere, he's like, no. and then he just sent me to the podcast with you. So it seems as though, it's a desert with no voices in the wilderness.
Okay.
Pretty much. It seems that way. I haven't dug into it, but he has. So
it's interesting to sort of have maybe have a couple of emails with him. But the main thing that it was sold to me, the main thing, when I first asked, why was I circumcised or whatever, was you can't remember it, so it doesn't matter.
Well, that's really important, you see, because
that was the main sort of sales thing. It's like, do you remember it? No, well, does it matter?
Yeah. Because people don't have a clue about the psychology of trauma, which, as I said earlier, is that, the biggest traumas we can't remember them precisely because they're so harmful. So the idea that we can't remember something means it didn't harm us is actually reversed, it's inverted the truth there, I would say.
Well, I don't think that's the case with because I can't remember anything from that phase. So it's not that I blanked out the trauma. I think the first 3 or 4 years of my life, there's not a lot there.
No, well, I'm the same, but that was one of the first clues I had. I don't remember the first 7 years of my life and what's going on there. And you see, there's this assumption, we don't remember because we didn't exist then. We didn't have a mind or what have you. But what about bodily existence? Like, the body is somehow...
Or is this relating to the trauma of your birth? Coming down the birth.
Well, I do know about the facts of that, which are that my mother was induced. She was given these drugs, and that they cause contractions that are traumatic for the infant. And one of the supposed results is an inability to generate dopamine. So basically, I'm in constant state of anxiety because of that. So that I can more or less put the pieces together and say, okay, yeah. There's definitely evidence for all kinds of other traumas, but
but it sounds like a primary one.
That obviously was the original one, if you don't count my mother drinking alcohol in the womb, which I would count actually. So we've got to go before pre-birth, post-conception, pre-birth, that period, whatever the mother suffers.
Thank you so much for your candor. Sharing that, I that is so generous of you to share that with me. This will kind of tick over in my mind probably for a few days or something. I'm not going to be thinking about it, but it's the sort of thing. Over the next few days, I might get a thought about it, and then I might be able to offer some sort of. Uh-huh. I don't know, the key perhaps to a way of journeying to release, as we're talking about yoga and release, there might be an aspect of something that makes me think about, because when I'd have my moment, with regard to remembering my mum, there's like, okay, I've kind of looked, if that's the word, back into when I was carried in my mother's womb. But it's like, okay, the sort of the birth canal, I don't know if my mum had drugs or not, to be honest. She didn't take drugs, for sure. But Okay.
Well,
you know, there could be some abstract that kind of pops up, and it's like, that I get an understanding from it.
Well,
you know?
I didn't want to mention in this context that your memory of the circumcision, that you don't, I mean, it's remarkable you have any memory, of course, from the first week of your life, but that it wasn't, there was nothing specific around the physical trauma, a very literal trauma of circumcision, but relating to your mother and her emotional response, that seems consistent with some of the things I've read and intuited and deduced about how the infant in the first 2 years of its life is psychically enmeshed with the mother. Because while we're in the womb, we're physically one with the mother, but then when we come out, there's this transitional period where we don't have a sense of ourselves as separate. Even though we're physically separate, we're still, this is why I say I think this relates to how the psyche somehow it doesn't land for those first couple of years, because we're not individuated, we're kind of in this formless state. And so we're in the second womb, you could say, which is the mother's psyche then. And so everything that happens to the mother, I think, in those first couple of years, not just when we're in the womb, but even when we're out of the womb, affects us as if it's happening to us. I mean, at least if we witness it, and maybe even long distance as well. So
is your mum still alive?
No, she died like 6 years ago now.
Okay.
And actually, a lot of this I was only able to see after she died. Rather, I mean, I'm sure they are related, those two facts, but certainly it was impossible for me to see my mother as she was while she was alive because of this enmeshment, because very few people I think ever get psychically disenmeshed, partly because of this the trauma that we don't have a healthy attachment, so we can't ever actually individuate from our mothers. So my experience with my mother was that after she died I had this sudden backlash, if you will, and I was convinced that she was a really bad person, because I was starting to become conscious of aspects of her that I hadn't allowed myself to become conscious of while she was alive. And so there was this readjustment where I was like, oh my God, my mother was a vampire kind of feeling. And the circumstances of her death were quite unpleasant. Like, she physically looked like an Egyptian mummy. And so I was just kind of haunted by this. And then in the years since then, I've been recalibrating little by little, trying to get a sense of who my mother was, outside of my own enmeshment with her. So I think, your experience, I think there's something very significant, meaningful there in terms of trauma relating to her trauma.
You've kind of very unusually you've opened up a new avenue of, when I say unusually, I'm kind of, it's like, okay, I've got some self-examination to do as a result of this conversation. It's like, okay, I might, because there might be something that comes up in conversation or in thought or whatever, whereby it's okay, it could be that maybe I may have an understanding that I can serve you with. I can offer it, I can communicate, email you and tell you if I have an understanding that might actually relate to yours, or it might be a stepping stone back to you understanding yours. So perhaps this whole conversation actually is about initiating me to journey back, if that's the word, into my stuff that I've gone back to there, and perhaps there's kind of some key in my, if I re-examine that, because I've kind of not really gone over it that much, but it's like, oh, perhaps it's time to do that and see if that I can sort of come back with any sort of message about it that might in turn be of use to you,
Yeah, well, even without having to communicate it, whether it's very symbiotic, isn't it?
The
processes that we're on, so even if you integrate something new, that's going to be useful in itself, right, to everyone. So there's another thing then, that because we probably have to wind up very soon, this will be a bit more intellectual, and it's not directly to do with your story, but it's inspired by this conversation, and it's an awareness that's been growing over the last few weeks, the last few conversations, which relates to the father and what I was saying about the maintaining of the patriarchal lineage through kind of possessing the male son. that I think, you know, what I was trying to describe before, and that you were questioning me about, was, you know, this fragment of the psyche that kind of takes over the whole system and ostensibly to protect it, but then becomes like a prison guard that prevents embodiment. That thing, that model that I was trying to present to you, and how that relates to what I call the constructed identity, which is the false self. It's not who we are, right? It's just this temporary defense system against trauma that then just takes over the system, and it tells us that this is who we are, you know, and this is what all these spiritual disciplines and whatnot are supposedly how to get free of this. I think that this relates to ancestral patterns, and that, and this is going to sound very out there, but you know, you did suggest, you know, the black magic ritual and that whole thing, and this is my answer to what that might be in psychological terms, that this constructed identity, because it doesn't exist, because like it's a psychic fragment that experiences a kind of autonomy, it doesn't want to get integrated, because then it would get lose its imaginary autonomy. But as a result, I think that these fragments can actually continue after we die in some way. I mean, this is what I'm beginning to intuit anyway, by talking to various people, and it's just sort of taking form, that somehow these constructed identity fragments can survive death, and then, you know, however, in whatever form they do, and that the traumatic ritual such as circumcision may be a way to implant that ancestral fragment into the infant, and that is a way to actually, it's like harnessing them in some way. That's what I'm starting to think and recognize, you know, like I've got my grandfather, my father, I've got these kind of psychic forces that are running my consciousness that don't belong there, essentially. I mean, they are me because it's ancestral, but they're not, you know.
It's quite sort of sinister when you get into that stuff. And when I said, when I used the word black magic, it was because, you know, it's you know, cutting the end off a boy's penis by men dressed in black robes. I mean, that's why, when I say black magic, it was almost like sort of this screenshot of kind of men in dressed in black robes, you know.
Yeah, no doubt. Judaic ritual abuse, yeah.
I mean, yeah, that is the it's kind of that's it, isn't it? You know, if you did it to a cat or a donkey or a, you know, well, you know, blah, blah, that's what it be. So, you know, whether that it just fits into that archetype, but this idea that it could be that you're right, and that there's something sinister and kind of quite unpleasant about entertaining that thought, even though for me the process is about whatever the mechanisms are, whatever the systems are, is again, it's working with deeper and clearer integrity and intention to try and purify that whole process. So this, to me, that is just another thing that needs to be put right. So it's just, okay, it's another of the endless list of things that are wrong in this world.
Well, perhaps, but it may also be close to the original trauma. I mean, you were saying what's before the beginning, so that's almost like what's before the original trauma, where we've got Adam and Eve in the garden, but then pretty soon after that we've got Abraham and his Isaac. So it's, you know, it's tracing something back, I think. And to me, it's inseparable from experiencing the soul and the transmission of the soul bodily, and the beauty of that, of being fully present in this existence here and now. It's almost like there's twin streams. Like the more I go back into the dark of the past, the more this flow can flow. Like this, it's like going into a drain to unblock it, I guess. And
Going into trying to block it.
yeah.
You know, this okay, I'm going to send you something when we finish here that will tell you exactly what that process is about from my perspective. Going into a drain to unblock it. I mean, you know, I think we're going to call it quits now. I kind of it's time to sort of like say goodnight. But
yeah.
I'm going to send you my journal of my drain unblocking.
Okay.
Literally.
Are you a plumber?
Literally.
Yeah.
You. I mean, this is so apposite. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. How to unblock a drain.
Yeah.
You'll love it. You'll love it. It'll take you 10 minutes to read it, you know?
Even better.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when this world come tumbling down.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your prayer. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spilled when his world came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. Now here comes the monkey. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.